Thank you for downloading this special edition of A Point of View After the Vote from the BBC. In the first of a series of programmes by different leading thinkers on the implications of the vote to leave the European Union, here's the philosopher and former Rees lecturer, Honora O'Neill.
There's rather little on which the embattled protagonists of Leave and Remain agree or even communicate, as we watch the implosion of the two main political parties in a bonfire of accusations and name-calling, of backstabbing and ambition. It's hard to be optimistic about the capacity of either to address the serious issues that need addressing, to reach the compromises that will be needed in order to negotiate well, or to convince the electorate that the negotiated outcome, whatever that may be, is acceptable. Even the massive inroads into their former fiefs by UKIP and the Scottish National Party and the collapse of the Lib Dems have seemingly not led the major parties to consider how they need to change or why so many members of the public do not think them trustworthy. Much has gone wrong, and as it seems, not only during the campaign. One thing that's gone spectacularly wrong is the standard and tone of public debate. The referendum campaigners talked past one another, sometimes indulging in inflammatory rhetoric and unrealistic promises. The disarray that we now witness, and the retractions, revelations, and recriminations that spill out on a daily basis, show that large parts of each campaign failed to communicate with the public, did not offer adequate or honest accounts of the alternatives, and did not provide the basic means for voters to judge the real options, the real opportunities, or the real risks. There's now a lot of evidence that options were not set out adequately, responsibly, or effectively. The public could not find adequate reasons to believe the government's economic forecasts. Hardly surprising, since economic forecasts are a specialised art form based on complex assumptions about economic variables and unsuitable for mass communication. On the other hand, the public, including those who voted for Leave, were not given adequate reasons to believe the rosy claims made by the Brexiteers. Some of the more alluring of these were, of course, quickly discarded or retracted after the referendum. The protagonists both of Project Fear and of Project Fantasy did not explain accurately and simply what was at stake or what would happen in the event of each outcome. Neither the process of invoking Article 50, nor the role of Parliament in that process, nor the time it would take, nor the constitutional risks to Northern Ireland and Scotland, and thereby to the unity of the UK, were adequately communicated to voters by either campaign. Favoured scenarios for immigration and for future prosperity were simply asserted, and contrary evidence was rubbished. Independent information was also often impeded rather than provided. Institutions that have been set up to test and present expert and independent evidence on economic matters, the Bank of England, the Institute for Fiscal Studies, were accused of being partisan when they did so and were rubbished. Publicly funded institutions such as the Office for National Statistics and others, whose task is to provide evidence-based views, were placed in purdah, and any evidence they could have provided thereby silenced. The BBC duly provided coverage of differing opinions, but often failed to challenge or test unclear or dubious claims. Democracy doesn't work unless citizens can check and challenge the claims and arguments that are put forward in the public arena, and citizens were often not able to do so. Nor, it appears, did the government make preparations for the contingency of a majority voting for Brexit. A civil service unit for negotiating was not established until after the referendum. UK expertise in the complex minutiae of trade negotiations has been run down, yet it appears that no steps were being taken to repair this deficit. There was no communication of the process of invoking Article 50, and although the government repeatedly pointed out that the process of exit would be protracted, this too was routinely denied, once more without evidence provided. How did this depressing and pervasive democratic deficit come about, and how can it be repaired? The causes are multiple and complex, and I shall mention two deficiencies before trying to sketch what healthier public debate could provide. The first defect's an everyday matter, but the second is more fundamental. The everyday defect is that social media make it all too easy for people to imagine that they're aware of a spectrum of positions and evidence even when they're not. Social media are known to produce echo chambers that contribute to the radicalization of extremists who imagine that everyone endorses certain extreme views. But we're often much less aware of more routine ways in which social media can undermine democratic debate. Crowdsourcing is a good way of finding out about consumer products because each person's rating of a product is independent of others' ratings, so provides additional, relevant, indeed expert evidence. But crowdsourcing is a rotten way to support judgments about complex matters if the opinions encountered merely echo one another rather than providing additional evidence. Last year, at the meeting of a parliamentary group on hate speech, I realised just how insidious this can be. Facebook gave evidence to the group that they remove material that incites hatred or abuse after a certain number of complaints, informants thought usually after about 20. But they also reported that the material taken down is promptly reposted and remains available, creating a continuous torrent of abuse and incitement which may emanate from few voices and reflect few views, yet may seem to be widely endorsed. Public debate cannot flourish without adequately accurate, reasonably fair, and reasonably comprehensible reporting and interpretation. Unless the media make a range of views and evidence and arguments available and provide the context and commentary needed to assess them, public engagement will start off on the wrong foot. If the media ignore, caricature, or rubbish some positions, or sneer at or deride evidence that they dislike, democratic decision-making is hardly likely to work well. Yet it's commonly assumed that the media have no civic duties and that a free press is simply a press that is free to publish whatever its owners and editors wish to publish, provided that it is within the law. I think that this view confuses rights of self-expression with rights to press freedom. Both freedom of self-expression and press freedom are covered by the 20th century term freedom of expression, but they're quite different. Rights to self-expression are for individuals, and we often follow John Stuart Mill in thinking that individuals should enjoy well-protected rights to express themselves as they choose, which should be restricted only if their self-expression is likely to harm others, as in Mill's famous example of shouting fire in a crowded theatre where there is no fire. But Mill did not think that powerful institutions, including the media, have rights to self-expression. After all, they have no selves to express. He argued that a free press matters for different reasons, and above all, because it can support discussion and debate by ensuring that the public encounter a wide range of relevant evidence and opinion and can check and challenge what they read, hear, and see. Press freedom is essential for civic purposes rather than to enable the press to express itself. If we're to have adequate standards for public debate, we need media that take their civic responsibilities seriously. The media often acknowledge this civic duty, claiming that their task is to hold power to account. But during the referendum campaigns, large parts of the media joined in the campaigning activities of the powerful rather than in holding them to account. The standards that the media must respect if they're to meet civic needs are hardly novel. They include honesty, accuracy, clarity, commitment to correcting errors and to indicating uncertainty, as well as standards of respect for persons that require journalists and broadcasters, like others, not to abuse, defame, misrepresent, intrude on privacy, or to injure or breach others' rights. These are important standards for all personal, public, and civic life, and of prime importance for the media, because they are necessary for effective communication that doesn't mislead. Where these standards are flouted or ignored, citizens cannot check or challenge what they read, hear, or see. Of course, accuracy is often hard, and nobody expects the media to achieve flawless accuracy. any more than they expect individuals, businesses, or government to achieve flawless accuracy. But they do expect the media, like others, to attempt accuracy, to correct errors once discovered, and to make sure that corrections are communicated to those who might otherwise base their views and action on misleading content. Accuracy alone, however, is not enough for good communication. The public also need media that support, rather than undermine, their efforts to judge what they read, hear, and see. That support may be a matter of providing context and of covering both corroborating and contrary evidence on a routine basis. Often this is helped by explaining where the evidence comes from and the level of assurance that can be placed in it. While there's a narrow case for the media to withhold information about sources where this is in the public interest, the media in a free society have no general license to hide or fail to provide information about the sources and credibility of material they publish, nor would this be in the interest of the media. Although there will be a few cases in which there's a public interest in not revealing sources, the public interest is always in understanding where information comes from and whether it's credible or not. Without this, it's too hard for readers, listeners, or viewers to judge what's trustworthy and what untrustworthy. And needless to say, it is an abuse of the public to pretend to have sources where there are none, or to fail to reveal the sources that are known to be untrustworthy or to be interested parties. At their best, free media support and protect significant public goods that are necessary for democracy by enabling robust communication, supporting rather than sidestepping citizens' needs for information, and providing commentary that enables critical assessment of claims and counterclaims. These standards for media communication make serious demands. Media that are attentive to the needs of citizens can make significant contributions to public good. They can provide access to a wide and varied pool of information and to the critical standards that enable intelligent assessment of that information and engagement with other views. They can provide a shared sense of the public space and support for citizens' confidence and capacity to communicate with others who do not have the same views. They can support shared enjoyment of cultural and sporting occasions that would otherwise be the preserve of the few or the privileged. They can also help citizens to understand the diversity of views held by fellow citizens and by foreigners. They can support realistic assessment of what can be done and what cannot be done, and can help citizens to judge who is spreading fear or fantasy and who is not. When things go badly, we often hear demands to know who's to blame. Parts of the media find this a particularly alluring question at present and point out, with some accuracy, that many politicians and political parties are to blame. But blaming looks backwards and doesn't help to resolve problems. The more important questions, both for politicians and for the media now, look to the future. Both need to provide credible and honest information for the public. How and when should negotiations begin? How separate will exit negotiations be from negotiations on future arrangements? How long are both likely to take? How is the unity of the UK to be preserved in the face of the situations in Scotland and Northern Ireland, and of a prospective land border of the EU across the island of Ireland? Is the unity of the UK up for negotiation? How far are UK citizens living elsewhere in the EU to be protected, and how far are they not? The media will play their important civic role only if they provide credible, accessible, and assessable evidence that bears on these and other basic questions.
A Point of View After the Vote was written and presented by Honora O'Neill. The programme was produced by me, Sheila Cook. And you'll be able to hear the other programmes in this series via the Radio 4 website.